Welcome to New World Notes, jotted down by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear parts of an interesting documentary film called The Crisis of Civilization. It's not as dreary and depressing as the title suggests, I promise. It's a thoughtful, reasonable explanation of how the many crises we are facing are all connected. The narrator makes a lot of sense, and there's even some fun along the way. I hope you'll stay tuned. And there's part of the fun right off. I love low-budget documentaries, and The Crisis of Civilization is one of them. For one, they make great radio. Essentially, films like this are a lecture, illustrated with old stock film footage. I love that old black and white stuff, the audio as well as the video. And the more the old stuff is propaganda, the more I love it. How about those crescendos we just heard, and those kettle drums? I've completely forgotten what the video was at that point. Could have been Hitler invading Poland. Could have been the Israelites crossing the Red Sea. Could have been anything. Who cares? Give me some more of those kettle drums. Later, we'll hear a great clip from an old corporate-sponsored propaganda film about how we white people are courageously developing the Arab soil for the sake of humanity and for the good of the peoples of the Middle East. Great stuff! Makes you proud to be an ExxonMobil stockholder. The Crisis of Civilization is directed by Dean Puckett, and it's written and spoken by Nafiz Masadek Ahmed. He's from England, where he's a professor, and he runs a think tank on conflict and international relations. Here he takes a look at seven different crises Western civilization is facing, and he shows how the crises are all interconnected. Crises like climate change, peak oil, world hunger, economic instability and militarization, to name five. All connected, and we're not going to fix any of them without fixing the others, too. The film is 2 hours long, so we'll pick and choose the best parts, this week and next. Today we'll blithely skip over climate change, peak energy, and food distribution, and we'll hear what Ahmed has to say about global economic instability and then terrorism, keeping in mind that both are connected to everything else. Here's a heads up. Late in this installment, Ahmed discusses a fact about Afghanistan, a fact that's important and well documented and little known. The U.S. invasion of Afghanistan was planned for October 2001, planned and set in motion before 9/11. The now 11-year-old war in Afghanistan was never about Mr. bin Laden, and it has very little to do with the Taliban. It does have something to do with peak oil, though. Here's part of the film's introduction, then on we go to economic instability and then terrorism.
If we look at what's going on in the world today, we see so many different things happening at the same time, and it can be very confusing trying to make sense of the debates around these things. But when you actually look at these things holistically, it starts to make some sense. Unfortunately, what we have at the moment is a lot of people in different fields looking at everything in isolation. So you've got one lot of people looking at climate change, one lot of people looking at energy, a bunch of guys looking at food, some other guys looking at the economy, some other guys looking at terrorism and foreign policy. And what I think is really important to do is to look at these things as part of a global system. And when you do that, you actually come away with a different perspective. If you look at these things in their totality, what we're seeing is industrial civilization is unsustainable. And all of these different crises are really just different manifestations of the fact that this civilization in its current form cannot survive the 21st century.
Hello, I'm Mr. Money. People can't seem to get along without me as cash or credit.
Well, here we are again.
Yeah. Oh, hi, Mr. Money.
Hello, John. And how are you today, Judy?
Just great.
You remember our learning machine over there?
Well, sure, that's a great gadget.
What's it going to teach us today, Mr. Money?
I'll turn it on and you'll see.
One of the areas where we're seeing the feedback effects of different crises is the economic recession. It's very, very clear that the underlying issue of energy and our ability to sustain economic growth has been dependent on the cheap, widely available abundance of fossil fuels. This goes against the grain of neoliberal economic theory, which analyzes everything in isolation and doesn't acknowledge that the economy is embedded in the environment, that the economy is embedded in energy sources. Currently, we have a fractional reserve banking system. This system is based on the idea that you have a certain amount of assets in reserve in your bank, and that you have the ability to lend out certain multiples of that asset in the form of money. So, for example, you have £1 in reserve. You can lend out multiples of 8 to 10 times the amount that you actually have. What they said in the 1990s is, this is not enough. We want new ways of making money. We want to be able to lend unlimited amounts. How can we do that? They said, let's have risk assessment models created by banks. And they would assess the levels of risk using these complex computer models. And if you could prove with these quantitative models that your levels of risk were very, very small, they could then justify lending at multiples of 1,000 times the amount that you've got in your reserves. And this is what made the whole process of financialization very, very interesting for capitalists, because you didn't have to produce anything. You didn't have to produce goods and services anymore. All you had to do was lend money to someone else who might be making goods and services or selling a product. And the more you lent them, the more they had to pay you back on compound interest. Obviously, you can see that this system was pretty much unsustainable because the global economy is a closed circle. I mean, how are you going to pay back money that isn't in the system? For you to pay it back, you need to borrow more. And for you to pay it back, you need to produce more, and you need to exploit the environment more, and you need to grow more. So it accelerated the pressure for unlimited growth.
Millions of people use credit to buy the things that add up to a better living.
Well, there's sure a lot of things that I'd like to buy for better living. How about giving me a little credit?
Nobody gives you credit, John. It's something you have to earn.
I don't understand, Mr. Money. How can you earn credit?
Well, we'll select another channel on the learning machine by remote control and see.
In the late 90s, banks were going crazy lending to people. And one of the areas where they were making the biggest profits was in housing markets and on mortgages, where they were lending to people who they knew couldn't pay it back.
You have a good reputation. We know you're reliable.
I'm glad you think so.
Here's the note, and this is where you signed.
They were then repackaging these mortgages as financial products that were safe to invest in, and then were selling them on. They were then saying, in the case that there was a default and that the guy didn't actually pay back the mortgage, we'll insure you, so you don't have to worry, it's very, very safe. The guys who were insuring, they didn't have any capital either. They didn't have any money to insure, and they were taking money in. And it was just this massive bubble. It became something like $1.2 quadrillion in size. That's $1,000 trillion of virtual money. Compare that to $60 trillion, which was the value of the real-world economy. So what you're seeing is there's a massive disparity between real life, buying and selling, and this virtual financialization debt bubble. What happened in 2005 to 2008 is that that bubble reached the limits of the energy system, the reality check, that you can't grow infinitely. There is a real world, which is the boundary limit of what you can do. And at that point in 2008, when oil supply was dipping and demand was growing, that bubble is almost as if it was in a box. It couldn't grow anymore, and it just burst. And at that point, the prices rocketed, inflation went through the roof, food prices went up, cost of living went up. Obviously, oil prices were going up, and that was driving the prices of everything else going up. Because of all of these factors, people found it incredibly difficult to repay their mortgages. Because mortgages underpinned so much of the growth that was going on in the economy, it was a tipping point that ended up collapsing the whole house of cards. But if you look at how governments are responding, they're not looking at the system and trying to change it. Instead, they're strengthening and centralizing it more. So who were the first people to suffer as a consequence of the recession? It was your average consumer. It was your average person on the street. The taxpayers, whose money went into a massive bank bailout, which was used to cover up the insolvency of the banks. What that did in practice is that it centralized the power of the banks. It gave them a pat on the head that after you guys royally cocked up, we're going to pay you some more money from the taxpayers who suffered. And meanwhile, by taking that money out of the economy, they actually made things worse. So you contracted the real economy, the productive economy, where things were needing to happen. And you created more business failures, more small business failures, more real economy contraction. At the same time, while these businesses failed, the larger companies, especially the big banks, who were now empowered by the massive bailouts that had come in, they started buying up a lot of these other businesses. So you had a situation where more centralization of ownership was also taking place. The reason why governments are responding in a way which is not dealing with the real issues is because they're adhering to this neoliberal ideology of the so-called free market system, which promotes this idea that states should have a really limited role in the economy and that we should just completely open markets and give free rein to private investors to pretty much do what they like. The reason there's a fundamental conflict between the free market ideology as it stands, or as it's promoted, and real world democracy as we would like it to be, is just because we elect our representatives in order for them to actually organize societies, organize economies, you know, make policy decisions that are for everybody's benefit. But what the free market ideology does is it organizes the economy in such a way that the state should actually have no real role. So in other words, the free market ideology is actually taking power for these economic decisions and transactions completely out of the hands of the public and giving free rein to all manner of actors and vested interests that have nothing to do with the popular will. Now this ideology on a global scale is being pushed through by these global governance institutions, mainly the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, as well as the World Trade Organization. And what they're doing in countries in the South are often suffering from huge levels of deprivation. They have many political and social problems and they do need credit. Is they're saying to these countries that if you're going to receive our loans, then you're going to have to abide by our rules for development. And what this actually does is it forces these countries to restructure their societies on the basis of these structural adjustment packages, to open their markets, to completely deregulate their societies, and to allow these private investors, largely based in the West, to come in and pretty much do what they like, to buy up resources, to invest, to take out capital whenever they feel like it. Essentially, it opens up these societies to the predatory exploits of transnational capital based in the West.
Hello, George. Jim Chandler. I have a gentleman I'd like to bring over to talk about locating a factory here. I thought you would. 11? Fine, we'll be there.
What this means is that neoliberal globalization, a so-called free market ideology, is a broken system. It hasn't worked. On the pretext of creating growth and creating wealth, which they say is going to somehow trickle down to everybody, what they've actually done is centralize profits for a minority is extract the resources, raw materials and labour within these countries for the benefit of a few, while accelerating huge levels of deprivation and debt in most of the world.
And this process has empowered northern industrial centres to continue on this path of overconsumption and unlimited growth, which in turn has accelerated global crises. We've explored climate change, peak energy, food insecurity, economic crises. We've seen how these crises are all fundamentally interrelated and that they're being driven by this ideology of neoliberal capitalism. And if we look at the war on terror, we can see that Samuel Huntington's ideas about the clash of civilizations have become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
International terrorism is often viewed as a problem that is either outside Western civilization and competing with it, or internal to communities who happen to be part of Western civilization but are not truly accepting of it and challenging it from within. That's putting it very simplistically, but that's the general sense of the conventional way of approaching terrorism. A quite different picture emerges when you start tracking the financial infrastructure behind actual international terrorist networks. So if you look at most of the Islamist-affiliated terrorist groups linked to Al-Qaeda, there is generally a consistent set of evidence which shows that they are financed by certain groups of states in the Middle East and Central Asia, states like Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. One of the other interesting issues that isn't well known is the way in which the West has intersected with this relationship and why the West has done so.
May 29th, 1933, after weeks of discussions, there was a meeting at Kazan Palace on the outskirts of Jeddah. It was there that Saudi Arab government officials representing His Majesty signed a concession covering roughly 320,000 square miles. This was the starting point of a new American business venture abroad. But ahead, there was a long, long distance to travel. A huge investment. Years of effort. And no end of patience and perseverance.
It's very important that we recognize how significant hydrocarbon energy resources are to the international system. To maintain production, to maintain electricity, to maintain agriculture, we are dependent on certain types of fossil fuel resources.
The problem is that most of these resources are available largely in specific areas of the Middle East and Central Asia.
And historically, for us to have actually maintained control and access to these resources in a cheap way, in an easy way, what we've done is we have teamed up with very, very repressive regimes in these regions, Saudi Arabia being one example, who are willing to supply to us on the terms that we like, cheap sources of oil and gas. Part of the process has involved militarily propping up these regimes at any cost. We know for a fact that these regimes are also sponsoring terrorist activities. So there is a clear decision that's been made in the sense that we have continued to maintain ties with these regimes, knowing full well what's going on. The other issue is that not only have we done that, we've actually gone further than that. In order to control hydrocarbon energy resources and to extend that control, we've actually got more involved in the sponsorship of those groups and used them deliberately as mercenary proxy force in order to destabilize certain strategic regions that are either access routes to this kind of energy or actually hold that kind of energy. The policy of using proxy forces has happened in many regions. One of the most obvious examples is in Afghanistan, where we know this happened during the Cold War. The US funded Osama bin Laden and his Mujahideen in order to counter the Soviet Union, the pretext being that we were fighting international communism. The wider context that we are not always familiar with is that Afghanistan has a very important geostrategic position in the international system, and this has been expressed by many experts in geopolitics. One of the most influential is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was National Security Advisor to President Carter and more recently an unofficial advisor to President Obama. He wrote a book called The Grand Chessboard, where he emphasized Afghanistan's relationship to the wider Eurasian continent in terms of an access point, and that maintaining control of Eurasia is instrumental to maintaining US hegemony in general. Brzezinski was also instrumental in kick-starting the policy of funding bin Laden and the Mujahideen in order to kick the Soviets out of Afghanistan, whose presence would have undermined US control in the region. But that relationship didn't end in Afghanistan at the end of the Cold War. The conventional opinion is that the US disconnected from bin Laden, he turned against the West, started bombing Western targets, and that this escalated until 9/11, at which point we had to respond in the form of the War on Terror. There are broad areas of that narrative that I might say are correct, but there are fundamental problems with it, and one of the most fundamental problems is that we never really disconnected from Osama bin Laden. This has been corroborated by a number of intelligence experts. One of the most well-known is Sibel Edmonds, who after 9/11 was translating hundreds of pre-9/11 intelligence documents for the FBI. And she has confirmed that Osama bin Laden and the Taliban were sponsored by US intelligence services all the way up to 9/11 at the very least. She was interviewed behind closed doors by the 9/11 Commission, but none of her testimony made it into the public record, and she has been repeatedly gagged by the US government and risks imprisonment for speaking out. What this shows us is that due to our rabid overdependence on fossil fuels, we have become very used to using terrorist groups to destabilize certain strategic regions in order to integrate them into the global political economy and access their valuable resources.
Now that the risks have been taken, now that the pioneering has been done, the way is open for other American companies to come into the Middle East and join in developing its great resources for the benefit of its people and of the world.
The West has been manipulating these groups for very specific geopolitical interests. We know that this was happening with the sponsorship of the Taliban all the way through the 1990s, with the primary interest being that the Taliban would pave the way for sufficient stability to have a trans-Afghan gas pipeline route to Central Asian resources. The envisaged pipeline that would run through Afghanistan was supposed to be a way of accessing largely at that time unexplored reserves of oil and gas in the Caspian Sea, and it would cut across Pakistan, bypass Russia, and it would bypass Iran and transport this gas to Western markets. What we find is that in late 2000, the US government started to have doubts about the Taliban's ability to really pull this off. And this was because the Taliban was fighting a civil war with the Northern Alliance for which there was no end in sight. So from the year 2000 to 2001, the United States government convened a series of meetings and negotiations with the Taliban. The Taliban were basically told, you're not going to have a stable government by yourself. The Northern Alliance is continuing to fight with you. We need you to join up with the Northern Alliance, the former federal government. And if you do that, you'll get all the aid, you'll get international legitimacy, and we can continue with the gas pipeline. And the Taliban, being the hardliners that they were, said, no, thanks. We are the legitimate representative government of Afghanistan, we believe, and we're going to stay where we are. And 3 months before 9/11 was when the last meeting occurred, and the Taliban boycotted this meeting. But they were represented by Pakistani Foreign Minister Niaz Naik, who confirmed that the United States government had proposed to the Taliban that if they didn't comply with this federalization plan, that there would be military action to eliminate the Taliban, and that this action would occur by around mid-October that year, which is exactly when the war in Afghanistan actually occurred. The phrase that was used was that they would get either a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs. And what this shows us is that the war in Afghanistan was not about fighting terrorism. It was not even a direct response to 9/11. It was already being planned. 9/11 just provided the pretext, and it was much more to do with accessing regional resources than anything to do with human rights or fighting terrorism. And now you see with the escalation of the war in Afghanistan, right now US and British forces are trying to expel the Taliban from the southern region of Afghanistan, which is precisely where the Trans-Afghan pipeline is supposed to run.
What we can say with certainty is that the system generates terrorism as a phenomenon, that terrorism has become integral to the way the system works, and this justifies the state's militarization of foreign policy, and it also justifies the state's increasingly draconian treatment of its own citizens. Overall, we are facing these multiple converging crises.
Climate change, energy, food, the economy, and even terrorism, all of which are escalating.
What's happening in this context is that rather than dealing with the root structural causes of these crises,
which are often rooted in state policies and interstate policies, what you're seeing instead is states are much more able and willing to maximize their military capacity to maintain the structure of an unequal global economic system, often using terrorism as a justification. And we find that a parallel process is happening domestically. Governments are increasingly enacting more and more legislation that encroaches on civil liberties, that allows them to survey communities, monitor people's lives, their ability to control their populations, their ability to counteract the rise of dissident movements.
And we shall hear that next week. Nafees Mossadeq Ahmed showing how growing militarization and destruction of civil liberties at home, how they fit in with the financial crisis and the energy crisis and everything else. And don't expect a word about any of this from any of the corporate-sponsored candidates this election season. You know who they are. You're listening to our two-part adaptation of The Crisis of Civilization on New World Notes, and I thank you for listening. You can find all our broadcasts at the website newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum, support your local farmer, please come back next week, and ciao.